We turn once again this evening to the book of Revelation, and we come now to the 13th chapter in the book of Revelation. Last Wednesday, you may remember, we began to consider chapter 12, and we made the point that not only do we begin a new section in the book of Revelation in chapter 12, but we begin the second half of the book. And the first 11 chapters in this book of Revelation deal basically with things that take place upon the earth in the experience of the church. But from chapter 12, we are, as it were, led behind the scenes, and we are given reasons why it is that the church experiences the difficulties and the opposition that it does experience according to the first 11 chapters, or certain portions of them particularly. And it's in chapter 12 onwards that we are led to deal with the personalities who are opposed to God. And basically, we find that there are three prominent personalities or personages who are presented to us. And these are, of course, the dragon and the beast and the false prophet. And from chapter 12 onwards, we find ourselves progressively introduced to these personalities and powers. We're introduced to the dragon in chapter 12, and in chapter 13 we're introduced to the beast and the false prophet in these two beasts that arise in this chapter. Chapter 12 is a summary of the earthly ministry of Jesus Christ. We saw how his birth, his incarnation is emphasized at the beginning of the chapter, and how the dragon was ready to destroy him, how Christ was taken up into glory. No mention of his humiliation, simply of his victory, because the book of Revelation is not concerned to emphasize the suffering of Christ. It is intended to emphasize the glory of Christ. And so the child who was born of the woman was taken up into glory. We saw the casting out of Satan. We saw how the people of God in this world, they overcome the wiles of the devil by the blood of the Lamb. And we were focusing our attention particularly on the closing verses of chapter 12 last time, from verse 13 to 17. And the devil, knowing that he has only got a short time in which to do his work, he makes war with the woman. The woman is preserved in the wilderness, given a place where she is nourished and kept, as it were, by the wings of the great eagle. And we're told at the last verse, you remember, 17, the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed. That is all the descendants of the woman, all the children of the church. That's Christian people. And here we have a picture of the conflict between the devil and the church in this final summary, verse 17. He went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And we finished off making the point that to the degree that we keep the commandments of God and bear the testimony of Jesus Christ, to that extent we will feel the brunt of the devil's wrath and opposition. But all of that, of course, raises a question. And the question is, how is it that the dragon goes about making war against the seed of the woman? How does he do it? What are his instruments, or what are his emissaries in the world? What organizations does he use? What personages? Who are the opponents of Christianity in the world? And that is what we find in chapter 13. We have a picture of two beasts. First of all, there is the beast that arises out of the sea, in verses 1 to 10, and then from verse 11 of chapter 13 to the end of the chapter, we have the beast arising out of the earth. I was considering simply looking at this chapter in one sermon, but on more sober reflection, there's far, far too much here for one sermon, at least for me. And when I preached through the book of Revelation a fair number of years ago now, I actually spent four Sundays looking at this chapter. So even tonight, we are summarizing a great deal. But what we're going to be doing is looking first of all at the first 10 verses, the beast out of the sea, and then, God willing, next time we shall look at the beast who arises out of the earth. And we're to try to understand who these are and what is it that we're being told about them. Because here we are reminded, given very clearly, the powers in the world by whom and through whom the devil makes war against the people of God. And both of these beasts, in fact, are described as being opposed to the people of God. So we're going to limit our attention this evening to the opening 10 verses of Revelation chapter 13. And here we have the first beast who arises out of the sea. And the first thing that we notice immediately, of course, is the description that is given of this beast in the opening two verses. I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him power, and his seat, or literally his throne, and gave to him a great authority. And here we have a summary description of the first beast who arises out of the sea. And the symbolism, of course, of arising out of the sea, as far as the Bible is concerned, is this is the sea of humanity. This is the sea of human sin. In the Bible, in the book of Revelation, for example, in chapter 57, you remember the wicked people on the earth, the nations that know not God. They are described as being like the troubled sea which cannot rest. And the symbolism of the sea is used in the scriptures in a number of places. We come across it again in chapter 17, the great whore who sits upon the waters. And so the picture of the troubled sea is the picture of a fallen and a troubled humanity. And it is interesting that when we come to chapter 21 in the book of Revelation, at verse 1, when John is describing the new heaven and the new earth, he reminds us in that verse in chapter 21 that there is no more sea. In other words, the things that characterize our troubled world, these things have forever gone. And the sea is characteristic of the division of people, nation from nation, one man from another man. It's a picture of turbulence, depth, deceitfulness. At times it appears most pleasant and calm, but at the next moment it can erupt into a dangerous place to be. So this is a suitable imagery for the fallen condition of humanity. So we are being reminded immediately that this beast who arises, he comes in some way out of the sin of man, and he is one of the expressions, therefore, of the sin of man. But you notice that when you come to the actual description that is given to him, you will, I'm sure, immediately relate the description that is given here to what we have already read concerning the dragon. You remember in chapter 12, we're told in chapter 12 at verse 3, "And there appeared another wonder in heaven, behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his heads." And here we have the beast also having 7 heads and 10 horns. And upon his head, his horns, there were the 10 crowns. And upon his heads, the name of blasphemy. So immediately we are being reminded that even although this beast arises out of humanity, out of the sinful humanity that is characteristic of this present world, we are immediately being reminded that this is not humanity after the image of God. This is humanity after the image of the devil. Here is man, not in his God-likeness, but in his demonic condition. Here is man more like the devil than he is like God, in whose image he was made originally. So here we have this picture then of a beast, and he is intimately related to fallen humanity, and he is intimately connected to the red dragon, whom we have been introduced in chapter 12, and is described in verse 9 of that chapter as being the devil and Satan. That great dragon was cast into the earth, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole earth. So we are left in no doubt whatsoever as to the identity of the dragon. And John here is giving to us the identity of the beast. He is one who is like the dragon in so many ways. But I'm sure you also immediately relate this image of the beast out of the sea to that passage that we were reading in the book of Daniel from verse 3 onwards. Daniel there sees visions. And you remember he saw the four beasts that were arising. And the beasts that Daniel saw, three of the beasts, were characterized by exactly the same imagery that we have here in this beast here. The beast which I saw was like a leopard. We find that Daniel's third beast was like a leopard. His feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. John is reversing the order in which Daniel gives the description of the first three beasts who were arising. And there was a fourth beast arose in Daniel's vision. The fourth beast is not mentioned here, and there's good reasons why. Because we believe that we're in the time, and John was in the time of the fourth beast, the Roman Empire, but that's another matter of study. But the point is, it is evident that what John is recording here is precisely the same imagery that Daniel was seeing. Daniel was seeing the kingdoms of this world arising one after the other. And the four kingdoms we believe that Daniel was seeing were the kingdom of Babylon, and then the kingdom of Medo-Persia, and then the kingdom of the Greeks. And then the fourth image was more fierce than the others, and it was the kingdom of Rome, which was the supreme persecutor of the Christian people at the time that John is writing the book of Revelation. So what John is seeing is world powers. He is seeing the kingdoms of this world arising one after the other. And one is different from the other. They're all different. When you look at the historical details concerning all the kingdoms that we find in the Old Testament, they're all different. And yet John is saying they're all the same. The kingdoms of this world, for all the differences, are united together in something that is much, much more common among them. And that is that they are more demonic than godlike. So there are no godly kingdoms in this world. This is basically what this image is telling us. And it is reminding us that from the earliest times until the end of time, there are going to be a whole series of empires and kingdoms, nations, every kind of human institution. And they are all going to be characterized by antagonism to the Christian gospel. And so it is utterly futile, it is foolish for Christian people to imagine that the governments of this world are going to be really sympathetic to the gospel. It is something that the Bible makes very clear. We are living in a hostile environment as Christians. This world is not our home, and the powers of this world are not our friends ultimately. And Christian people have been duped, as we're going to see by the next beast. They have been duped to worship the first beast, and they have made an unholy alliance, which inevitably has led to the detrimental outcome as far as the church is concerned. So the first thing that we have to understand is, here we have a description of the world, the powers that be in the world. They arise out of fallen humanity, but they are given their authority by the devil. We're told at the end of verse number 2, and the dragon gave him power and his throne and great authority. And ultimately, the real driving power and purpose and the ambitions of the governments of this world, whatever flavor they be, left or right or center, it doesn't matter. Ultimately, they are not for the glory of God. They are for the glory of man. And man ultimately is the supreme antichrist. When the man of sin is revealed, It is mankind in his sheer ungodliness towards the end of time. Man is going to stand naked, exposed as the anti-God creature upon the face of the earth. This is the picture that we have, and this is what John is reminding us about here. So first of all, we have the description. It is a description of humanity in every age, in every culture, and it is beastly and demonic and devilish and anti-Christian. But the second thing that we notice about this beast from the sea is that in verse number 3, we are told one of his heads, and I saw one of his heads as it was wounded, literally killed to death. And his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. What is the significance of this rather interesting statement in verse 3? One of the heads of this beast was slain, and yet it seemed to be revived again. And the answer is very simple. It means you can't slay this beast. It means that when there comes a time when one kingdom comes down, and we imagine that that's the end of anti-God powers in the world, evil rises up in another form. The Babylonian kingdom was defeated by the Persians, and in due time the Persians showed a measure of friendliness to the Jews, but it was a political friendliness. Israel was to be a buffer state between Persia and Egypt. There was no real sympathy on the part of Cyrus or the Persian rulers for the faith of Israel. They never knew the God of Israel. They had no desire to know him. And then once the Persian power was put down, there was the Greek power arose up. And Hellenization, as we know, was a tremendous danger to the Jewish people. They wanted to embrace Hellenistic philosophy, Greek culture, and Greek practice. And the faith of the people of Israel in Old Testament times almost disappeared from the face of the earth. Not by persecution, but by, as it were, a sophisticated lifestyle. It came in a different form. And then the Romans came, and they suppressed the Greeks, and they oppressed the Jews. And so it is down through history. One nation seems to die. It happens at the end of the Second World War, for example. The Western nations, they breathed a sigh of relief that Nazism had been obliterated, they thought, from the face of the earth. And then another form of totalitarian anti-Christian government, communist Russia and the Iron Curtain bloc. And it's the same right down, one nation after the other. Each have their time of oppression, and the church sometimes think that the time is over and now we can live at peace. But it's never going to be like that. When one head seems to be put to death, it revives again. It's the same beast that revives, perhaps in a different form. And that reminds us, you see, that there is no perfect society in this world. There is no perfect church in this world. There is going to be no utopia. There is no point in Christian people looking for a perfect congregation. It doesn't exist. It never has existed. There are no perfect people. There are no perfect Christians. There are no perfect ministers or elders. Because we are all infected with the fallenness of humanity. And to some degree or other, the beast always has some kind of influence upon the people of God. And so the people of God sometimes are longing for a time when we can live at peace with the governments of this world. For example, now, I'm not advocating rebellion or any such thing. Of course not. The powers that be are ordained of God, and we submit to them. But the idea that the Christian church can make an alliance with political parties and power is a very dangerous delusion. The Bible does not teach that. The purpose of the gospel is not to establish some kind of Christian international commonwealth upon the earth. The purpose of the Christian church is to establish God's kingdom among men and to bring men into the kingdom of God and not into the kingdom of man as such. The book of Revelation has been described as the tale of two cities. There's the city of Babylon, and Babylon is this world, and there is the city of Jerusalem, the heavenly Zion, and there's going to be no peace, and the beast is not going to be slain ultimately until Christ comes again And we're told that at the end of chapter 19 in the book of Revelation. When is it that this beast is really slain? We're told at verse 20, chapter 19 in the book of Revelation is a picture of Christ coming again in glory. And there's the great conflict and the final battle. And the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast alive into a lake of fire burning with brimstone. So it's not until Christ comes again. You see, the church cannot overcome the beast. The beast can overcome the church and often does. But the Christian community will never be able to contend with the beast. We can never overcome the world. The world is too strong for us. The world is given an authority that is demonic. And as long as this world stands, the devil and the worldly powers will always seem to have, and sometimes in reality have, the upper hand. Because as we're going to see towards the end of the sermon this evening, this beast makes war against the saints and he overcomes them, according to verse 8, number 7 of this same chapter. So here we have a description of the beast. We also have a description of one of his heads, which seems finally to have received the death blow, but it revives again. And then we're told of the world's response to this beast. One would think, would you not, that the world would be afraid and have nothing to do with such a monster who is described. We're told here, and all the world wondered after the beast, and they worshipped the dragon, which gave authority and power unto the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And then again in verses 7 and 8, and it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Now, what is the picture that is being presented here of the world going after the beast and worshiping the dragon? If you were to put this to worldly-minded people today, they would be appalled at the suggestion that they are worshiping a beast and worshiping the dragon. But you see, as far as the Bible concerns, we all worship something or other. And if we do not worship the Creator, then we worship the creation. Something is going to take supreme place in our lives. It needn't be a religious worship, you see. Worship in the Bible is not limited simply to religious activities. It can be reverence for something. Worship means giving something its due place or its supreme place. And when we are commanded to worship God, we are simply being commanded by God to give him the first place. But it may be that we're giving people the first place in our lives. It may be that we're giving money on the stock market the first place in our lives. It may be sex. It may be drugs. It may be pleasure. It may be sport. It may be art. It may be political power and interest. It can be a whole galaxy, a whole multitude of things. But the point is, you see, it all together is taking our minds and our affections away from worshiping God. We as Christian people are to set our minds upon things that are above. The unconverted man, the Apostle Paul tells us, they mind earthly things. And these are the things that occupy the world, the nations of the world. National pride, the flag, economic security, all these kinds of issues. It is all subsumed under this general description of worshiping the dragon, because he is behind it all. The God of this world, he blinds the minds of those who do not believe the gospel. They are blinded, blinded nations. They may well have a religion that is idolatrous in terms of images, but they may be atheists and secularists, but they're still blinded, blinded to the glory of God and the glory of the gospel, because they're blinded by the God of this world. And right at the heart of idolatrous worship is the worship of demons. And so this is what John is saying. This is the explanation, you see, as to why the world goes after the beast, because the beast seems to give the world the very things it wants. What does the beast promise? What do the politicians promise? They promise us the good life, don't they? One after the other. When are people in Australia going to wake up to the false promises of the politicians? We will do this, we will do that. And time after time, surely by now, have we not learned the lesson? You just don't believe a word of what they're saying. And they may well have good intentions, but they haven't the ability and the moral integrity to carry out tough policies. And so the point is, you see, the beast, he promises the good life. Caesar said on one occasion, when the people are in a riotous mood, he said, give them bread. Prime ministers in Australia are going to be habitually characterized by, when there's unrest in the people of the nation, give them money, give them $700 each, and that'll shut them up for a time. And so it goes on and on. This is the picture. The beast gives to the people what they want. And so they admire the beast and they follow him and they support him and they give their allegiance. And the gospel of Jesus Christ comes a poor second. I mean, what do we have to offer the multitudes of the world? Toil, tears, sweat, faith, heaven afterwards. But in this world, tribulation, belonging to the minority group always, the people who seem to be so ridiculous, God chooses the weak things of the world to confound the strong and the mighty and the wise. And the world looks at the church and it sees the church as totally ineffective and increasingly irrelevant. And the beast and all the interesting things that the world has to offer, much more exciting and attractive. And our appetite is whetted, you see. And this is why the world, the nations, and the kindreds, without exception, there is one exception, and that is all of those whose names were not written in the book of the life of the Lamb, verse 8. All shall follow the beast. Everybody's going to follow the beast, not everybody. Those whose names are written in the Lamb's book of life, they shall not follow the beast. They shall follow the Lord. Our Lord Jesus Christ, you remember, tells us in Matthew 24 that the false prophets who are going to come, we'll see them next time. The false religions of the world, they perform signs and wonders that if it were possible, they would deceive even the very elect. But they can't deceive the elect. The implication in Matthew chapter 24 is that God's elect, they may be deceived on a lot of issues, but they are not deceived concerning the person and the work of Christ. On that, Christian people are agreed and clear. And so we have a description of the beast. We have his deadly wound, which was healed. We have the world going after him. And then we're told this about him, the sheer blasphemy of the beast. At verse number 5. At verse 1, we're told, upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And then at verse 5, and there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And notice here this blasphemy. It's given to him. And we could say, well, it was given to him by the dragon, and that probably is true up to a point. But it's also given to him by God, because we're told that he is given this ability to blaspheme for the period of 42 months. Now, we've already seen this 42 months, you remember, way back in chapter 11, where we were told in verse number 2, the outer court, the worldly church and the world at large, but the court which is without the temple was not to be measured. That is not to be secured and sealed as God's people. They are not to measure it, for it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot for 42 months. So here again, you see, we're back to this same period that is described as 3.5 years, half a time, 42 months. 1260 days at 30 days per month. And so it's the same period of time. And so what we are being reminded here is that during this time period when the witnesses for God are witnessing, the powers of darkness are unleashed, and the beast increasingly blasphemes. This beast blasphemes against God. Now, what does blasphemy mean? We might, and we're not wrong, to think of blasphemy as speaking against God. We're told in verse 6, he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his temple. In other words, to say things against God and against God's temple, against them that dwell in heaven. So here is a power on earth that is speaking against God and heavenly things and holiness. But that is not the only meaning that the Bible has to blasphemy. The idea of blasphemy is not only to speak against God. It is to speak as though you yourself were God. It is to speak as God speaks. We have an example of that in Matthew chapter 9. You remember at verse 3. Jesus on one occasion said to a man, your sins are forgiven you. And there were some of the scribes, you remember, who were sitting by, and they heard Jesus say that. And they said, this man is blaspheming, because nobody can forgive sins except God alone. Now, all Jesus was doing was speaking as though he were God. And he was speaking as though he were God. But these scribes, they recognized that there was an element of blasphemy. If this is not right, if this man is not God, then he is in fact blaspheming. You and I know that Jesus Christ was not blaspheming when he was speaking as God. He could forgive sins. The Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. So here is the beast, you see. And he is not only speaking against the God of heaven and the dwellers in heaven and God's tabernacle, but he is usurping God's place. And in 2 Thessalonians, we are told that the final manifestation of the man of sin, of humanity, in his fallen condition, in his fallen religion, and in his fallen politics, is that he sets himself up as though he were God. He will determine who is to live and who is to die. He will determine the shape of things to come. He will determine what laws are to be obeyed and what laws are not to be obeyed. In other words, man in his rebellion puts God aside and speaks as though he himself were the ultimate wisdom and lawgiver. That's what this is. And you and I are living in a time when blasphemy is increasingly accepted. There was a time, I can't speak for Australia, but there was a time in Britain, in Scotland at least, when blasphemy, to speak and take God's name in vain, was a crime. You could be punished for it. It was a crime to curse God. And you could be hauled up before a court. You go out into the streets of Sydney tonight, or any place you care to mention, and you will find God's name taken in vain by little children who are learning it from their parents. And it's in the playgrounds and schools because they're learning it from their teachers. And increasingly, it seems to me, it's even being found in the mouths of professing Christians who quite frankly speak about God too frequently in a way that is not meant to be spoken about. That's blasphemy. And so what we have here is a picture of a world that is increasingly dominated by anti-God and anti-Christian thinking and acting and speaking. And then we're told also, and I must hurry, we're told of the conflict that there is between this beast and God's people. It was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given, authority was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. What does this verse mean? It means that there is always a conflict until the end of time. There is always warfare between this beast and God's people. Makes war with the saints. But if my understanding of Revelation is correct, it means that there's going to be an increasing warfare. And the Christian church is going to come to the point where it almost ceases to exist upon the face of the earth. Is that not what we've already read about? You remember in chapter 7 at verse 11? When they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them and shall overcome them and shall kill them. Towards the end of time, the Christian community is going to be but a remnant. It will seem to have been totally overcome by the anti-Christian power. And they shall be slain. But then there is this little addendum here. And it's rather interesting, I think. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. Whenever it is true that Christianity has been overcome and removed from a society, and there are quite a number of places in history where that has happened. We can think of the Middle East, lands that are now Islamic. We can think of the early church in India, churches that once flourished in Japan for a time. They were expelled, indeed persecuted out of existence. And what replaces them? If Christianity is not the dominant worldview of a society, what is the worldview going to be? It is going to be the worldview of the beast. The beast will step in when the saints are slain and overcome. And this happens in a family, it happens in our own lives. When Christianity is expunged, then the beast comes in and he is given power over us. All kindreds and tongues and nations. That's the malignity and the magnitude of this beast who comes out of the sea. Fallen humanity welcomes him because he is part of him. And the final thing this evening is verses 9 and 10. The appeal that is given to pay attention to all of this. If any man have an ear, let him hear. What is it that we're to listen to? We're to listen to the consequences of following the beast. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. The first thing we're to pay attention to is this. If we are allied with the beast, we are doomed to destruction. But if we are not allied with the beast, then we will be allied with Christ. And that is why the final statement of verse 10 is here, is the patience or the endurance and the faith of the saints. There is the following of the beast, or there is the following of Christ, and that requires endurance and it requires faith. But in the end, it leads to life. Everyone who is not written in the Lamb's Book of Life and who follows the beast is destined for the destiny of the beast. And that is defeat and destruction at the last. And for those of us who do not follow the beast and who do not worship him and do not subscribe to his worldview and live differently, we're going to need patience and endurance and faith. And that's precisely what we have as Christians. Because faith is God's gift. And he gives strength to his people. And there are times in the history of the church when we need more strength and more patience and more endurance than at other times. These two beasts in chapter 13 in Revelation, these are the instruments and the emissaries of the dragon in his wrath against the people of God and against God. So let us be under no delusions concerning the worldly powers all around us. Let us not fall into the mistake of thinking that it's wonderful. It is demonic because it ultimately has no place for Christ. And that is the ultimate mark of the beast. And as we're going to see, it's the mark also of the false prophet. He looks like a lamb, but when he opens his mouth, he talks like the dragon. We'll see what that means next time. So this is how the devil goes about his work. And you and I have to have ears to hear and to understand the kind of world in which we live and our own place in it. May God bless his word to us.